Well, we are talking about the mysteries tonight, the Egyptian ones and the Hebrew ones. And we start out with one of the most wonderful stories. See, so far, every one of our ascension stories has come out of Egypt. One going back as far as the 11th dynasty. Yet the principal protagonists have been biblical characters. So now we come to what is perhaps the most remarkable story of all, the famous tale of Joseph and Asenath, in which Egypt and Israel are put on equal footing. You know who Asenath was? It's our great ancestress, the mother of Joseph and Joseph's wife, the mother of Ephraim and Manasseh. We're descended from her. She's our grandmother. It's very important. Joseph, you know, but we'll have to take Asenath now. Like our other hypocephalous stories, it's strangely aloof from the mainstream. The great scholar Kohler tells us, Jewish scholar tells us, neither rabbinical nor patristic literature has preserved any trace of the story. The Jewish and Christian traditions have no trace of it at all. That is a very important one. And Filonienko, who makes the most thorough edition of the text, the one that's available now, notes, he says, that the religious theme is absolutely unique. Now, nobody knew about this thing at all, except everybody did. Scholars disagree widely as to its date, its place of authorship. The name Asenath has been read as Aramaic, Babylonian, Hebrew, Greek, so forth. But we know what it is now. It's a perfectly good Egyptian name. We'll mention that. Among many manuscripts, our little epic is in many languages. There are 40 manuscripts in Armenian alone. So it's a very popular story, and yet none of the religious people know anything about it. There's little a scope of discovering the original version. The story itself is found to contain elements, very easily recognizable elements, of Apocrypha and scriptures and classical mythology and hagiography, that's stories of the saints, and the Greco-Roman novella in the Hellenistic time, the romantic novel became very popular, in which some see strong influence of certain cultic initiatory rites of the minor mysteries and other mysteries. Merkelbach, Turkan, and others have discussed that. But the closest ties of all are, would you guess it, with the Testament of Abraham, the one we already talked about, which you've already glanced at. For the romantic part of the tale, Filonienko goes to the 19th dynasty Egyptian romance of the foredoomed prince. Now that writing is contemporary with the fall of Troy. They have something to do with it. And this makes it appropriate for Filonienko and others to equate Asenath with Helen of Troy. There is still no complete agreement as to the original language. I said the oldest and shortest text is in Slavonic, just exactly as the Book of Enoch, the oldest Book of Enoch, was until they discovered the Hebrew in 1951. And the Apocalypse of Abraham, the oldest Abraham, that's in Slavonic too. We notice how it happens to be in Slavonic, because in the 9th and 10th centuries, many pilgrims poured in from the new Russian Empire, the Ruriks. Your Scandinavian ancestors settled Russia there, you know, along the river. And they came down and they made pilgrimages to the Holy Land, and they picked up manuscripts there which were translated by monks in Palestine and brought back to Russia. But they weren't made in Russia, and they were very old and went back to the early times. Well, Joseph and Asenath, Filonienko concludes, is a mystic romance written in Greek during the Roman in Egypt period, the Roman period in Egypt, by a Jew of Egyptian origin. Not only of Egyptian birth and culture, but possessing, he says, a profound knowledge of Egyptian theology, especially the Heliopolitan cosmology. Well, that's exactly what the Joseph Smith is. Remember, the Joseph Smith has the word Heliopolis 3 and probably 4 times in the rim. No other hypocephalus does that. Joseph Smith is strictly Heliopolitan, and this document was by a Heliopolitan theologian. And he knew that as only an Egyptian could know it, he says. And it was Joseph Smith himself who first declared the document to be cosmological. Egyptian theology, he says, especially Heliopolitan cosmology, as only an Egyptian could know it. And of course, Joseph Smith first pointed out that what you have in hypocephalus is cosmology. Well, and is Heliopolitan too. At the same time, it was Joseph who put it in the patriarchal setting. Now, at this late date, we discover that it belongs along with the Book of Abraham. This story belongs to the Book of Abraham. These things all flow together here. But she's very important for us, you know. And the story of Joseph and Asenath turns out to be the last of the great patriarchal romances. Notice the patriarchal romances are really romantic. That makes her contemporary with Helen of Troy, the first great classical romance, you see. Was written at the same time. But Abraham and Sarah is a very romantic story, as you know, in which the woman is always the equal. She is the fair damsel who is wooed, who holds the whip handle all the way through. Remember, Abraham must appeal to her, "Will you do this not for me, please?" He says, "If you say this and this, you'll save my life, and I'll be very grateful for that." So she's a princess, as her name shows, and he defers to her on many occasions. They're romantic because you don't feel in a really romantic situation, you feel anything but male chauvinism, because the wooer is at her feet. I mean, this is the cult of the lady and so on. Well, and then you have Isaac, the story of Isaac, Rebecca, and Jacob, and Judah, finally. But this culminates in the most romantic figure of all the patriarchs, and we can call him a patriarch because he's our patriarch. If you come from Ephraim, then you're a descendant of Joseph. He's your patriarch. And so the most romantic of all is Joseph and the jewel of the Nile, our own great-grandmother, Asenath. She was pure Egyptian. She was pure Egyptian at that time. That mixed with every conceivable race you can imagine. So we're quite mixed up here. And remember, the brothers Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh was where Lehi came from. So we had that same blood. It was all mixed up, and both of them. Half Manasseh out in the desert there, they're Arab, they're everything else. Well, the problem of the writer, the story of this book called Joseph and Asenath, is to explain how Joseph the Just, he's called, how did he come to marry the daughter of the world's highest ranking pagan, Potiphar, the high priest of Heliopolis? She was his daughter. She was the daughter of the high priest of Heliopolis, direct pure blood of Ham. What's going on here? And the question is, how can that happen? Well, this shocked the rabbis, so they invented the story. But it's not the Egyptian one. The Egyptians give a different one. The rabbis found the proposition quite unacceptable and proceeded with practiced skill to produce pious stories demonstrating that Asenath wasn't Egyptian at all, but in reality was the daughter of Dinah, the sister of Levi and Simeon. Remember the affair that happened at Shechem there. How then did she ever end up as a child in the court of Heliopolis? Among a number of convenient explanations, the favorite was that it was a bird who took her to Egypt, and by far the most important version of that, according to Filonenko, was a Syriac account telling how, on a day when Potiphar went to the temple of On, the Heliopolis, to perform his priestly duties, reminds you of the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, doesn't it? He beheld lying on the altar the babe Asenath, wrapped in swaddling clothes, and an eagle with wings extended above the little girl. Now, can we have the first slide? Yes, we'll have to plunge us in darkness, won't we? Yes, we showed you this before, but you're going to see where that idea could come from. This is the very small mummy that's wrapped up. It is not like, it's not free and liberated like the mummy is in the Joseph Smith papyri and so forth. But this is a very small one, and it's in wrapping. But I was thinking of the one at Esna, from the temple at Esna, there's one of a child wrapped, it is a child, it's a baby Horus, wrapped up, and the bird with outspread wings above him. See, on the lion couch, there's usually outspread wings above the figure there. And that's probably where they got it. Remember, it was agreed that where they got a lot of this stuff was from the Book of the Dead, and so the Abraham stories. But just as the famous, well, anyway, an eagle with wings extended above the little girl. So there's a little mummy figure on a couch with the usual bird with a hawk's head on it, the hawk or the eagle. The bird had brought the child from Canaan to its nest in Heliopolis, and the bird was the phoenix, the one that's mentioned three times on the rim of the Joseph Smith hypocephalus again. The phoenix bird at Heliopolis. That's where it nests. It always nests. It's Sun City, you see, that's the center, where it renews life every 500 years it flies back to Heliopolis to burn itself up and then rise from the ashes again. The resurrection bird that perches on the Benben stone and the Ahu in the house of the great one of the Benben at Heliopolis. And that's a quotation from Rabbi Eliezer. He mentions that even. That it's, we mentioned that before, including King Alfred. Just as the famous psychostasy scene, the way the court scene where they weigh the heart and the scales and so forth, the courtroom scene from the 125th chapter of the Book of the Dead is thought to have supplied an important feature in Abraham's picture of the other world, so the author of Asenath's translation from Palestine to Egypt was helped by hints from other vignettes, the well-wrapped figures with hawks on the lion couch hovering above them. There's one at Edfu here in which Khonsu appears, quote, as a small boy in the form of a mummy along with Horus the hawk above him. So you can see where this idea would come from. But anyway, the author, of course that's interesting, we've talked about that before, because actually here we have a figure on a lion couch and notice the name above it is Abraham. And that absolutely shocked everybody when that came out. We talked about that before, won't read now. But the author of Joseph and Asenath, a very Egyptian Jew, rejects all the rabbinical tales of the lady's Israelitish origin, perhaps he wrote before them anyway, and provides instead a thoroughly Egyptian solution to the problem of how the mixed marriage was possible. The Egyptian Asenath undergoes a sacrificial death. She dies, but she does not die. Well, we heard that theme before. For at the last moment, she's revised and reborn as an Israelite, transformed, but still herself. That's a hekaru for you. Her story begins with Joseph driving his golden chariot into the court of Heliopolis, the world center of sun worship, exactly at noon on the day of the summer solstice. Notice everything matches here. The place, the time, it's Heliopolis. It's exactly noon, the sun at the highest point of the day, and at the summer solstice when the sun is at the highest point of the sky. Wearing around his head a 12-jeweled nimbus, a dazzling crown of flame from which 12 golden rays shoot forth, because we think of the crown that was on Isaac's head. He leaves no doubt of his identity. Yes, we think not only of the gold sun crown on Abraham and Isaac, they both had, but also of the gold hypocephalus that they found recently. You know. And now, behold, this is what Asenath says, and now, behold, the Son of Heaven is come to us. S-U-N, sun. The whole story, quote, is an astronomical allegory in which Joseph represents the sun and Asenath the moon. Could we have another picture? It may be the right one. Well, go to the next one, then we can reverse and get back to this one. That's Asenath. Yes, here, this is the well-known marriage of the sun and the moon. It's a theme in all mythologies, you know. And you see the first one, what she's saying, Sagadir, Bidish Sugaharsamsai, I swear to you to be obedient to you, she says to him. And he says to her, sound backwards, O Luna, O Moon, Sagvir, dein Gemach zu werden, promise me to be my Gemal. Promise me that you, Sagmir, mein Gemal zu werden, he says, promise me that you will be my wife. And she says, I vow to be obedient to you. But notice it's the sun and the moon. She's standing on the moon, he's standing on the sun. And this is a universal theme. Let us modestly rush on back to the other one now. This is the story that illustrates the Asenath. When it's just carried on, it was a popular medieval story and so forth. Yes, see. Give me some light, yes. Well, so it's an astronomical allegory. Joseph represents the sun and Asenath the moon in a hieros gamos, a sacred marriage which begets the race. That's right, that's good. The youthful hero has just completed his rounds of the city and the land and is ready to go forth, as he tells his 12 attendants, naturally 12, to make my rounds, kikloso, he says, of all the land and the earth. This is just like the opening lines of our handbook to the hypocephalus, where remember, opening lines of the Iliad, well known. Well, it is right, 37th line of the first book of the Iliad, where he says he has to go his rounds, the sun, the god, it's Apollo in that case, goes his rounds visiting one shrine after him. Kilante jatha etina doya lifianosis. He goes from one shrine to another, visited in turn, as the sun goes and visits his 12 houses of the zodiac or whatever you have here. It's the same thing here. The youthful hero, the sun, you see, has just completed his rounds to the city and the land and is ready to go forth, tells his attendants, to make my rounds of all the land. And we call the opening lines, where it says, where the sun god is the great courser in his rounds. Joseph is a faithful image of the solar Apollo, and the wedding is to be the mystic union of Helena, or Selena, the moon, you see, with Helios. For before the new life cycle can begin, a new life must be assured by a sacred marriage to beget the new generation, the new race of human beings, and so forth. This theme we're all familiar with now. Upon arriving at the temple, Joseph sits on the throne of Potiphar. I think the name means given of Ray. Remember, if you have that in the book of Abraham, it was a hill, Potiphar's hill, which was called Olishem, and that makes very good sense. Olishem means the hill of the sun, and Potiphar means that which belongs to the sun. Potiphar, you see. Pa, di, in Egyptian, pa, he who, a di, is granted or given, was granted by Ray, a gift of Ray. And Potiphar washes his feet and prepares a meal for him, just as Abraham did for the angel and Hezekiah did for the prophet. But Asenath scornfully rejects her father's wish that she marry Joseph, sees the moon lady, haughty and aloof in her tower, and it's surrounded in, it's described in considerable detail as an astronomical wonder. She gives you the view of the heavens. I have two of them already, and so I will not thirst after righteousness later. But the well, she scornfully rejects her power of wish to marry Joseph. She is very haughty. She's in her tower surrounded by 72 guards, you see, at the four, at the 18 at each of the four windows, the four cardinal points. A full description of the place suggests nothing so much as a planetarium. She has to be equal distance where she stands between the Dipper and Orion, and she is in Aries. She must always be in the center constellation of Aries. We've seen the ram all over the place when you're going to make these changes, you know. Well, but when the damsel meets Joseph face to face, they are reconciled as brother and sister and fall in love. See, it's a romantic story. But it's too late. Joseph Smith must resume his celestial circuit, and Asenath is left to mourn her indiscretion. She's turned him down. She has offended both her father and Joseph and has no claim to either Egypt or Israel. She's a non-person and has no choice but to die. With an iron bolt, she locks herself into a room high in the tower. This is the tower theme. If you could put it up a little, you'd see the lions at the bottom. That's not so important because this is a medieval later version. She locks herself, telling her maids outside that she's too weak ever to open it again. Then, as the sun goes down, she dons black weeds of death, throws all her possessions out of the north window, the death side, covers the floor and herself with ashes, throws herself down in the dust where she remains without motion for 7 days. There's a person who dies but doesn't die, because he doesn't die. You wouldn't believe it after that. To all appearances, quite dead. On the 8th day, at the point of death, now here it happens, you see this happens in every other case, she raises her head from the ground, and faces the east window and utters a prayer. Now, Philip Young could think this prayer is the center of the whole thing. It all centers around this. And as we know, all our stories began with the prayer for the person who is at the point of death, Abraham on the altar calling upon God, and he sends the angel of light, and the angel takes him up and so forth, shows him the Lord in heaven, gives him promises. Well, this is what's going to happen here too, only it's to the woman this time, our grandmother. The first half of the Asenath story is centered entirely around the prayer of Asenath, Philonenko, and it is the hypocephalous prayer, the prayer, the smitten one for deliverance. She says, "Hear my plea, I address my prayer to thee, O Lord. Stretch forth thy hands to me and snatch me from the hand of the enemy. Behold the wild lion," you see the lions at the foot. This is a romantic theme that's often repeated. This should better illustrate the story of the two brothers, as far as that goes. Well, the one of the foredoomed prince is the same thing, the lady in the tower who has to be rescued and so forth, and is a common theme, as you know, in the Middle Ages, of rescuing the lady from the tower. And here are the lions. But she says in her prayer, "Behold, the wild lion, the ancient one, pursues me. His children are the gods of Egypt." We started out in the first place, you see, with the lion. And their father, the devil, seeks to swallow me. The wolf, the abyss of fire, save me, O Lord, alone and helpless. So she's to be swallowed by the abyss. Satan, the destroyer, has just about finished with her. Exactly what Abraham's prayer is in the other things and all the rest of them. When she finished the prayer, we read, well, incidentally, this is important. Let's see the next one. Skip the indiscretion, but go on to the next one after that. This we all know. We should all know now. Yes, this is the Joseph Smith one, you see. Now here, this is what happens. We notice Moses is, Abraham is praying for deliverance here. And deliverance from what? Well, over some 200 lion couch scenes we have. No two of them are exactly alike. They follow pattern. This is the only one that has the crocodile there, that has the sobek there. And Joseph Smith calls him the idolatrous god of Pharaoh. Well, we wrote quite a spiel about it once. There are the canopic jars, but here is a crocodile. And this is unique. Now, what's the business of the crocodile? He is both blessed and cursed. The Egyptians loathed him and hated him. But as we mentioned right at the beginning here in the first lecture, they have an entirely new interpretation of death now. Death is a necessary process. It's a blessed process. The only way that you can get you through eternal life out of this flesh is to pass through death. You're stuck otherwise, and you're going to get out of it. But you must pass through death, and this is regarded as a blessing. So Sobek here, who is the god of Pharaoh? See, the royal house, the crocodile, Sobek, was the royal family's particular deity. And here, the service he performed, who would love the... who went to worship those hideous creatures, they perform that valuable service of getting rid of your mortal remains and seeing that you passed on to a more spiritual existence. The crocodile will take care of that if you're too physical. So this is why it's there. He's waiting to destroy him, and as it says here, save me, Lord. The gods of Egypt, notice, are his children, the gods of Egypt. And we're told that those four here, notice, these are called, Joseph calls them the idolatrous gods of Pharaoh, which absorb the inner parts of the person. And this is the person who finishes off the bones and any scraps that happen to be left. When she had finished her prayer, oh, yes, this is the cry in extremis from the lion couch, to seize and swallow her. And note, okay, the crocodile, in facsimile one of the book of Abraham, is found in none of the hundreds of other lion couch scenes of the type. This bids us take it seriously. The croc represents the new ideas about death in Egypt, a necessary process, so the crocodile is terrible, is nonetheless divine in his high office. Well, quoting the text again, when she had finished her prayer, the morning star arose. The angel comes to rescue her, sir. And this star is the angel, the angelos, the herald of light of the great day. The morning star announces a greater light forthwith. A man came down to her from heaven, a face like lightning, eyes like rays of the sun. His head was surrounded by a flame of fire. It was Michael. If you remember, the others saw that. John saw the same sort of thing, and Ezekiel and so forth, they all see this angel. Like a flame, it was Michael. And yet he was in the express image of Joseph. That's a typical Egyptian trick. Michael is Joseph's archetype, we're quoting here, and his tutelary angel, just as the other messenger is endowed with the Ba in the form of Horus. The subject of the two messengers, let's see the next one. Oh, incidentally, some people suggested that Joseph Smith had snuck that crocodile in there, or the engraver Headlock had done it. But let's have the next one, agree? But you see, here's the original now that proves beyond a doubt that it's there, because there it is. This is backwards, this got it backwards, doesn't make any difference, but where did I put that thing? Oh, it fell there. But see, it belonged in the original. See, you'll never find it on another one, but it's been drawn in. This is the original text, and an ancient scribe drew it in. It wasn't Joseph Smith or any of his followers that put it in. But it's put in as an afterthought. You notice the water and everything had been completed and drawn, and this in heavy and clumsy line is drawn in afterwards to make the story complete, as if he was going to adapt this picture to a particular story, which is, of course, what's happened here. And then, and it is, Yes. And yet it was in the express image of Joseph. From this day, he tells her, the angel of light, her angel of light husband tells her, from this day thou art renewed, recreated, reborn, reanimated to a new life, resurrection. It's rebirth, you see. She has died now. Remember, in every one of these stories, a person dies but doesn't die, just comes near it, calls out with his last breath, an angel comes and rescues him, and then he's a new person. Then he becomes a spiritual being. Remember, we have, as the Book of Mormon tells us, to be carnal-minded is death. And it is. That's the only place where caro, or flesh, is going. To be spiritually minded is eternal life. And though these spirits begin to find some things out. Well, from this day thou art renewed, and so forth. On the spot he gives her a new name, a very significant name, a strange one, which is City of Refuge. Could we have the next one now? I was going to talk about these. Oh, no, well, this is fine. This is, we can use it. They're all mixed up. Then another maiden enters, who is Metanoia, repentance, sent, says Athenus, to rescue me from the darkness and to lead me up to the light. So now we have two ladies to match the two messengers in the mysteries. Remember, this goes right back to coffin text 312, way back, 2300, 400 BC, very early times. And to lead her up to the light. So now we have these two ladies matching the two messengers, and one who promises to be a guide to higher regions. At their first meeting, Joseph had laid his hand upon Athena's head. Oh, I forgot a very important document, but we'll have to skip it then. Athena's head. And prayed to God to bring her from darkness to light, from error to truth, from death to life, renew her through the Holy Spirit, partake of the bread of life, drink from the cup of blessings, and be numbered among the chosen from the beginning of the world. That sounds strangely like Christian language, doesn't it? Sounds at least like the sectaries. It is gospel language. But be short, it's ancient and it's Egyptian. It's quite authentic, too. You have something like the magnificent temple tomb of the high priest, very important high priest and ruler, by the name of Petosiris from the Persian period, who left us what you might, dozens of passages taken, you'd say were taken right out of the Bible. But, so don't be shocked at this. This, which may sound so familiar to us, is the standard initiation theme of the ancient romances, incidentally. And now, the angel orders Athena to change her black robes to white, he takes her through the mystic marriage ceremony, in which she invites him to sit on the bed amidst a swarm of bees and to share a ritual feast, which is a honeycomb with him. That's the food of resurrection. The bee is the instrument of resurrection, as we know. Everyone sees strong Essene influence in this, and so forth. These were the things that I left home. But there's also a public wedding, for in the end, Joseph must sit on the throne of Pharaoh, whose authority, as is well known, comes from the female line. He would get it from Athena. The ceremony was performed by Pharaoh himself after the Egyptian custom. Quote, he placed the gold crowns upon their heads, such as were in his house of old. It's only after the Egyptian wedding at Heliopolis that the couple goes to Jacob for his blessing. He doesn't marry them, but he gives them his blessing. In the mystic marriage with the angel, Filonenko detects a very perceptible echo of the story of Isis and Osiris, the great Egyptian romance, which we have to thank Plutarch for, which takes us right back to Plutarch and the Book of the Dead. The sharing of the honeycomb and the swarming of the bees is an episode which has baffled all the critics. What we have here is an initiation comparable in many ways to that of the mystery cults, and we're quoting from the Comcola again, to the mystery cults, valuable evidence for the mystical Judaism whose existence has been the subject of much controversy. Was there a mystical Judaism? Not the Judaism of the rabbis, but something much older. Yes, there was. It comes out now. Today it's recognized that Asenath is a good Egyptian name. She belongs to Neith. She was or is the servant of the goddess Neith. Asenius, N-E-I-T-H. Mustn't mix that up with Nut. Now, Neith is a very important person. Well, the bees confirm that. For Neith is the prehistoric bee goddess of Chemos. And her temple is the castle of the bee. And since the bee cult and the bovines are inseparable, the cows, she's also the celestial cow. Herodotus tells us that. And she's Hathor, and she's Mut, she's the mother, and she's the mother cow, and she's the bee and all those at once. Her tower, we saw the lady on the tower, like a Cenis, is described in terms of an observatory. So she has a tower too, of course. Asenus is her servant. An observatory, a planetarium. Both ladies are flanked by the big and little bear, but find themselves within the constellation of the ram. The new name given to Asenus just before the bees swarmed over her was City of Refuge. A neat city in Sais was the bee marsh of Chemis, where the youthful and the babe Horus was hidden. A refuge from his enemies, from the enemy who tried to destroy him. It's the oldest earthly city and a mirror image of the celestial plan, just like the biblical city of refuge that Ezekiel saw and John so forth. It was the refuge of the infant Horus, the heavenly city viewed by Ezekiel, John, and the others. Sais was the name. It was the twin city of Athens on the Bee Rock. And everybody knows, in fact, that Athena and Neith are the same. The Greek writers use them interchangeably all the time. Where Athena is none other than Neith. Neith is referred to by classical writers simply as Athena, as a matter of fact, such as Herodotus, 2859, so forth, Philostratus, lots of them. So we have here Athena. Well, Neith, and Athena's a very important person, too. You know who she is. She lives on the Acropolis of Athens, and all around the Acropolis, as you know, are little caves and pits that were filled with beehives where the bees swarmed. That was the bee rock. The Acropolis was a bee rock too. But we think it's strange that a woman should be a city. We need only refer to 4th Ezra, the text closely associated with both the Asenath story and the hypocephalous motif. Ezra, having prayed on his bed of pain of Israel and for Israel in demise, is rescued by the angel Uriel. The angel comes and rescues him. He's shown the usual panorama of the cosmos, with the city divided into two halves, surrounded by the great circle of Oceanus, like our hypocephali are, with only one path between both. That's 4th Ezra 7 there. The woman who appeared to thee, says the angel to Ezra. Ezra, remember, who was the assistant of Jeremiah. The woman who appeared to thee is no likeness of a woman, but a builded city. This woman whom thou sawest is Zion. Now we're getting somewhere, the city. Whom thou beyond, remember, Zion makes herself beautiful and so forth. Maybe related to Zina, I think it does. It means beautiful, adorned. This woman whom thou sawest is Zion, whom thou beholdest as a builded city. And lo, thou hast seen the heavenly pattern of her, how she mourned her son. The round city, oh yes. The round city with the path between the halves recalls a Neopythagorean tablet of Kibis. I couldn't get a picture of that, in which Filonienko sees the best commentary on the conversion motif in the Asenath story. The sacred plate, there was a sacred plate, was kept in a temple designed in three concentric rings. I think we have, should we risk collection? No, I know what the next one will be. You remember, there's always three regions on a hypocephalus, three main regions, and the ocean ring on the outside. So it was in a temple designed in three concentric rings, two of them representing the ailing world, and the other the world of righteousness. Isn't that what you get to? Remember, the under part of the hypocephalus is always a world of darkness. It's also the womb. It's also the female part. It's also the moon part, and so forth. The doors led from one to the other, and the object was to pass over from the dark side to the light side. At her main shrine in Esna, Neith works with Khnum, the ram-headed god, as co-creator. Name, she is Khnum, described in a hymn from Esna, which I have here, well, as having four faces on one neck, and who do you think that is, you see? God of the strong voice whom none can see, the Lord of the tower who creates as he pleases. Khnum, author of the four Khnums, more eminent than any other god or goddess. Well, who can fail here to see the hypocephalus? Neith herself is, we're told, Khnum the creator, the ram of the great horns, ruling life and death, more powerful than Sekhmet, the lioness. Lord of heaven, earth, and the underworld, water and the mountain. Formula, that's the lady Khnum who is our friend Asenath. who shines in the heavens in the form of ray and the sun. Now I just got, would you sock it again? I'm going to try to find that hymn. Go on, keep skipping, and we'll get to that hymn. Keep going. You haven't got to the hymn. I mean, it's a text. It's a text. You'll be bored by these when they come around again. But here it is. This is the text from Esne. This is another of the Esne. Esne was her special capital and so forth. But this tells you who they are and how she's identified with everybody. And the top line tells us here, oh, you can't see the top line. It's pointing up too high there. Yes, it starts out. Yes, it starts out. E-U-N-T-P-E-L-F, U-F, the, O thou whom, whose character, notice it's written in, not in code exactly, but in a strange phonetic spelling. You find these on the walls of temples. So, Kapar thinks it's to challenge you to try and read them, because they're written in rubrics, and it's not the ordinary way of spelling, but if you read them out loud, you see what's saying about, what he's talking about. O thou whose character is that of the Sinefer Tzaddik, the builder of all living things, the builder of he's the great builder. Kawi-F is the Knum of the Tzaddik, who causes to build and causes to live. In the next line he says, O thou who art excellent of heart, well, whose noble heart is holds all things in abomination that tear down or destroy. Bevet, Bevet, Wehen. Bevet, Wehen. See, Wehen, see the wall falling down there. And Bevet is abomination. There's a stinking fish there. And here's his picture of his heart. If you just put together the pictures, see the determinants, you see whose heart, in whose heart a stinking fish is anything that destroys. And he builds and he never destroys. He only builds. He is the inspired builder, as Baidawi, who published this, says, well, the way it reads here, thou whose character is that of a life-giving builder, thou most noble of heart, to whom destruction is an abomination. And then it ends up by saying here, thou whose sister, Knum, this is Knum, that's his sister, we're talking about her now, they're talking about this lady Neat, whose sister is with him at Esne, his good sister, who prescribes the rules of the heavens, she who is in her year, the mistress of the stars, that which you see, so she is the lady in the strong room, that which exists arose through their word, the brother and sister combined, says that which exists arose through their word. They whose horizon is the precinct of Esne, which is called the pillar of Shud, which joins heaven and earth, the pillar that joins heaven and earth. Say, take one more. We might just hit Shu there. It'd be an accident if we did, but... Oh, let's do Joseph Smith. Let's go back now to where we were before. What a nuisance I'm making myself here. To the god of the four ram's heads, dominating the universe while concealing himself, one cannot fail to see the central figure of the hypocephalus. And that's why the last one I showed you was the hypocephalus. So you saw that one. You know what that is. They all got the four heads on the crown. She is called, Neat is called, the ram with four heads on one neck. That puts her in the center. But she's Lord of Heaven and the same thing. And we may add that the figures of the two worshipping apes that go on either side. Well, crowned with the sun and the moon, who customarily worship the Knum figure with upraised hands. You'll see that on yours. Shielding their eyes, you know, in his warming rays. Even so, Asenus sees Joseph, in Joseph both the sun and the all-seeing wedge-out eye from which he cannot escape, for it penetrates everywhere, she says, because of the great light that is in it. As to Shu, do we have Shu? He has a special affinity to the hypocephalus. When we come to it later, remember what I'm telling you now. As to Shu, that means our word. Well, empty. What do you mean? Like shadow and so forth. We have words that cognate with it. Shu means empty, hollow. It means air, space, void. But Shu is what's in between. It's the light that fills the immensity of space. He is the one who supports the wearers. Now you find that the the head cushion, which can take the place of a hydrocephalus. It's held up by a figure, and that figure is Shu. It has an inscription on it, usually, that alternates with the hydrocephalus inscription and says the purpose of the object is to raise the head, is to raise the dead and carry him right on up to heaven. I don't know where we get, well, we'll just have to explain these when we come to them. And how could the very feminine neat be the very masculine kanum? There was a special ingenious arrangement by which each is androgynous. Kanum is one-third feminine and neat is one-third masculine. A privilege is shared by them and no other couple. The same ration of male and female is found on most hypocephali. One-third, the bottom third, is represents the great mother, the cow and so forth, the underside. The other two-thirds, the male and the solar elements. What is more, Neith herself is the round cosmic pattern of the pectoral or crown, to say nothing of the city of refuge. Neith is the pectoral. Now, the name Neith itself means pectoral. It is written this way. Two bowls here. Strange thing. It's pronounced got. And it means pectoral, something you wear. Those are two bowls wrapped up. Means pectoral. Just before Asenath took her sky journey from Shechem to Heliopolis, her grandfather Jacob placed on her breast a golden pectoral with the ineffable name written on it for her protection. Now this is a pectoral. See, this is the moon pectoral, as you can see here. There's the moon. It might give us the next one too. This is a real beauty, the next one. See, there's the moon on the pectoral, the moon in the moon boat, and you have this, of course, on our hypocephalus picture. The ineffable name written on it for her protection. It was gold, of course, and that's gold. The word for pectoral, gat, is written simply by the sign of the lady Neith, her double reverse bow. And one of the oldest texts assures that Neith is the pectoral, even as she was Khnum. In the lengthy and archaic performance of Salt Papyrus 825, Professor Dershane calls the most important chapter of the ritual is primarily concerned with Neith, whose presence in the rites Dershane finds inexplicable. He doesn't understand it, though he says it must have some profound meaning. It's another hypocephalous mystery. The archaic rites in this Salt Papyrus are quite enlightening. They deserve to be quoted at some length, always with the hypocephalous in mind, aware that the pectoral is an alternate form of hypocephalous. Hypocephalous means under the head. Yet instructions in the handbook, which you cited, 162, you know, instructions in the handbook were expressly to place the goddess, the Hathor cow, which is in the center and soul of the hypocephalus, at the throat of the deceased, that is, on the breast. The writing was to go under the head. In various accounts by curious viewers of the Joseph Smith papyri in Kirtland and Nauvoo, no mention is ever made of the Joseph Smith hypocephalus being found on a round or on a solid base. An oddity that could not have been missed by many observant, hypercritical public, or wondering saints, who was described often as hypocephalus. They had many visitors, and they described them. They never mentioned the fact that hypocephalus was round on a special round separate. No, it was written on the sheet along with the rest of them. And they would hardly fail to notice and comment had the thing been under the head. They don't mention that it was found under the head either. Under the head of the mummy instead of on the breast of the rest of the documents. Just as various objects could perform the function of a hypocephalus, we hope to see later, and were placed under the head, or behind it, or before it, or on top of it, for that purpose, so the hypocephalus itself is found operating sometimes on the top of the head, behind it, or on the breast, or even under the feet of the mummy. The main object was to get it as near to the person as possible for it to exert the maximum effect. Horning has explained that. The rich variety of hypocephaly, like the great variety among the lion couch scenes and the reception scenes, facsimile 3, attest to the great freedom which the Egyptians enjoyed in arranging their text and symbol to the owner's taste, to emphasize one aspect or another of a situation. In the ancient and mysterious writing labeled Papyrus Salt 825, as I was naming before, which Gardner declared to be the most baffling text in all Egyptian literature, the hypocephalus seems to flash before us all over the place. It's sort of a logo of the Lady Neith. It goes, open to me the two doors of heaven, open to me the doors of the earth, that I may make my rounds among the household of the south, north, east, and west. There goes Ra, the sun speaking, you see, he's coming out at dawn. That I may go south, north, east, and make his circle. Though you are far from me, yet I am as wind among you. Saitha explains that. A chapter for the opening of the house, neath the pectoral, neath the pectoral. Pectoral is what you wear on your breast, the brushpas, you see. A pectoral. Neath the pectoral, I am neath the pectoral. I hide myself as one hidden. And there's a number of dark passages about hiding. Press it again, would you? I think we got where we have the royal throne. Well, there's another pectoral, you see. But this is the bird. This is that famous bird of light, the brilliant bird. He's the Menat bird, you know. He's Zab, which means variegated colors of all kind. That's Joseph Smith's speckled bird, you see. But notice it's Horus. Oops. Because you, well, okay, we've changed. So this is what, that's what I asked for. I deserve it. What you notice here, everybody wears a pectoral, a big pectoral. And you see, the idea is that the pectoral is supposed to be round. This piece of jewelry is awaiting her here, and that's the counterweight there, you see, which is a... And this is a rather dim photograph, but she's wearing one, and she's wearing one, you wear it, but it's supposed to go right around you and perform the same office as those things we were looking at. That big moon thing, she's wearing a different kind here, but it was very important to wear these. And this one says, I am the pectoral, I am the pectoral, yes. I am the one who hides himself in the flame. Remember, that's what a hypocephalus is, the flame, which does no harm. I am the one who hides himself in the flame, which does no harm. I am Ammon in the hypocephalus. The heaven abides in its secrets. The sea is calm before the flame. Geb, Nun, Nut, and Naunet, those are the four corners, all revolve together. The atom disk being their overseer, the sun. When he who inhabits the sky, the sun by day, has disappeared, as to the pectoral which is at the neck of Onurus, the lord of Thinus, it is a secret drawing. It's an image, a design, a likeness. See, we're dealing now with a very strong class of documents as a hypocephalus. And notice again, it is the likeness of the bald one, the great old man. We call him the Ancient of Days. Remember? Almost every hypocephalus begins the circle with the name of the great old man, the Ancient of Days, and ends up with the Ancient of Days in Heliopolis. It begins, you begin with him and you end with him. It's Adam, usually. And that's very clear in the Joseph Smith of the great old man. And it says here, it's a secret drawing, the pectoral, which is at the neck of Onurus, that is when he who is afar, Onurus, the lord of Thinus, is the secret drawing, the image or design, the likeness of the great old man to whom the all-important rim inscription begins and ends with him. And he is hidden in the presence of the rays of the sun. After he had revolted against his father, he wore this pectoral to protect himself from him. After he was overcome, it revived him instantly. See, that's the purpose of the hypocephalus, to sustain life, restore it when the time comes. What Shu said after he had put this charm around his neck. Shu is the one who lifts your head up, lifts you up to heaven. See, these things are so interchangeable. I have a, won't get to it though, I have a good quotation from Heisenberg on that very thing. There's nothing to stop you from referring to one in the same object in totally different ways, even when you're talking about physics. Yeah. That Shu said after he put his charm around his neck. Well, in algebra, anything can be anything as long as you understand what you're talking about. What Shu said after he had put his charm around his neck, O living one, enduring from day to day, who hides himself in life, even while the flame surrounds him as his protective charm. Well, I submit to you, we've got something very close to hypocephalus. This text, though, we are told, is a poor copy of an older one based on many ancient liturgical documents, but amidst the jumbling and repetition, we find the same combination and so forth. So here we have the hypocephalus Moses brought together in the usual confusion. Let's skip that now. In the airy history of Asenath, we have the opening cry of distress, the prayer to be rescued, the response of an angel of light to be raised up, to who raises up the victim of the dark adversary. We have the leading character, dead but not dead, being led to the throne of glory. This time it's not the throne of God, but Pharaoh, and in the end, Joseph sits on it. Not to worry, as we've seen in other texts, the hero passes through various heavens. Remember the other ascensions, the hero passes through various heavens and sees thrones at various levels, usually seven, three and seven, including his own throne. And since the writer was an Egyptian and Pharaoh, as the representative, was sat on the throne of divinity, and since such a throne is promised to the visitor in almost every version of the story, you have your Abraham is told, Enoch is told, John is told, Zechariah is told, Isaiah is told that his throne is there. You're seeing the same thing. We're still on target. What about the journey through the heavens with the angel, though? What about teaching cosmology with instruction to convey a popular drawing to those on earth? Well, the author of Joseph and Asenath was plainly aware of that incompleteness, for he seeks to remedy it by tacking onto the story, as the last section of it, an account of how Asenath proceeded to the throne as she was going to share it with Joseph. She was accompanied on either hand by her two uncles, Simeon and Levi. They had volunteered to protect her against the attacks by the henchmen of the envious son of Pharaoh, who he'd hoped to marry Asenath himself. Of course, he was jealous. He wanted to marry the daughter of the high priest. So he and his army attack, but the brothers of Dinah defeat them. You might know that. The Jewish version here declared war against Joseph. He's soundly beaten by the sons of Israel. The idea suggested by the defense of her mother Dinah by the same, well, of course, the idea, remember, the same two brothers, Levi and Simeon, went out and avenged Dinah by killing the prince at Shechem there. As they walked, we're told, Asenath held on to the hand of Levi because he was one of those who had seen the heavenly tablets. And because he'd seen the writings written on the heavens and understood them, he explained them to Asenath secretly, having seen a place of bliss in the Diamond City in the highest heaven. The Diamond Wall City, and that's going to be her name, is it? The place in heaven reserved for her on high. Levi himself had already made the spiritual ascension, and he had seen Asenath herself as the Diamond City, as the Diamond Wall City, Zion. Kohler compares this with Revelation 13:6, but declares what follows defies explanation. Well, this is what Levi's experience was, that Asenath was taught from him. Where he said, you have a place prepared for you there in the heavens and so forth. You're the Diamond Wall City. And he says, he starts out in the Testament of Levi, I was grieving for the race of the sun. Our usually story, the person is very depressed and grieving, and the angel comes. And I prayed to the Lord that I might be saved. Then there fell upon me a deep sleep, and I beheld a high mountain, and I was upon it. And behold, the heavens were open, and an angel of God said to me, Levi, enter. And I entered from the first to the second heaven, and I saw there a great sea suspended between them, between the heavens. That's the waters of Nun, the outer rim of every hypocephalus is that. You have to pass that. And the waters of Nun, and the sea between them. He sees the second and third heavens. And I said to the angel, why is this so? The angel said, marvel not, for thou shalt see another heaven more brilliant and incomparable. When thou hast ascended thither, thou shalt stand near the Lord and be his minister, and thou shalt declare his minister unto men on earth. So he again is going to be sent down after being taken his ascension story and seen everything. He's going to be sent down and have to record it. And then he wrote it down, and he taught Asenath from what he'd written. This is exactly what Abraham does, you see, in the Joseph Smith. I shall declare his mysteries unto men, and by thee and Judah shall the Lord appear unto men. The lowest heaven is gloomy, he's told, because it beholds all the unrighteous deeds of men. Now the two halves of the picture and so forth. The second is ready for the day of judgment. He sees the law court. They all do, you know. In it are all the spirits of retribution for vengeance on the lawless. The hosts ordained for the day of judgment. In the highest dwelling of all, as you might guess, is the great glory of the Holy of Holies, far above all holies. In the heaven next to this are thrones and dominions. But the sons of men have no perception of these things, and they sin, and God is provoked with them. And then it gives the apocalypse of destruction and bliss, above the destruction and bliss to come. And then said, the angel opened to me the gates of heaven, and I saw the holy temple, and upon a throne of glory the Most High said, I have given thee the blessings of the priesthood. It was Levi speaking, you see. And he gave me a shield and a sword. And I destroyed at that time the sons of Hamor, as is written in the heavenly tablets. And after these things I awakened. And when I was going to my father, I found a brazen shield. See, the angel gave him a shield, and when he came down to earth, he found a brazen shield. That's rather important. Yeah, we're going to be able to say something about that. I slew Shechem first, and Simeon slew Hamor. They persecuted Abraham, our father, when he was a stranger. Thus they did to all strangers, trying to justify himself. Whether it's a mystery romance, a Gnostic allegory, or an initiatory liturgy, and all these are suggested, the Asenath literature is always astronomical. The high tower with the windows to the cardinal points and the four iron pillars, each with its 18 guardsmen, the seven maidens compared with stars, seven other attendants who are called the lords of the poles of the sky, representing Ursa Major and Ursa Minor, and Lethesina and Nethrumber all between the constellations. All this suggests nothing so much as an astronomical observatory. Mixing Asena with Athena and Helen is not as far-fetched as it sounds. There's one special episode in Homer, an odd intrusion, a block of archaic material which has been recognized by Francis Schmidt in his Strasbourg dissertation and so forth, as clearly repeated in the Testament of Abraham. That is the famous and baffling story, another baffling story, of the shield of Achilles. We just talked about the shield that Levi got, both the shield the angel gave him and the shield God he found when he landed on the earth. He has to have two shields, that one, the original. Well, here's another one of those. Since the scholars freely associate Asenath with both Athena, Neith, and Helen of Troy, one is curious to know if there's a hypocephalous element in the Iliad, the book in which both those ladies, both Helen of Troy and Athena, play leading roles. We might be accused at this point of being carried away were it not that those same scholars who were in 1967 at the big convention, those same scholars who were quick to recognize Egyptian elements in Abraham's view of the fullness of the world and its circle, which he was shown by the angel, were equally prompt to accept Schmidt's announcement that the same imagery meets us graphically set forth in the famous shield of Achilles, which looks just like the heaven that the angel showed to Abraham. Indeed, it was the first Christian apologist, Justin Martyr, who pointed out that Moses' description of God's creation is just like Homer's discourse on the shield, and explained the coincidence by suggesting that Homer, I'm quoting from Justin Martyr now, that Homer, having learned about these things from Moses during a visit to Egypt, he explained it, well, Homer visited Egypt, and Moses was in Egypt at that time, and they talked with each other, and that's where he found it all. Homer got it from Moses. He transferred them in graphic design to the shield of Achilles as the work of creation by Hephaestus. And Hephaestus is our pal, Khnum. This is nothing else but Khnum. Well, so we see the first and greatest of the Christian apologists tells us that the first and greatest teacher of the Greeks, Homer, spoke to the first and greatest teacher of the Hebrews, Moses, and told him about the grand things in Egypt, and in Egypt they shared the knowledge of Abraham. A coincidence. So, it will be recalled that Hephaestus was both the creator, as Khnum. Oh, I should write Khnum here, he's a funny name, isn't it? Always he has the ram's horns, but his wife Neith is more often described as the lady who is the pectoral, but also the four ram's heads on one neck, who sits on the throne in the center. But so he is both the creator of the word and the god of artisans, and they both. Oh, he's on that hymn I showed you. He's described very fully on that. Was both the creator of the world and the god of artisans. In both capacities, he's always equated with the Egyptian Khnum, who, in me to remind you, is the male counterpart of Neith, Athena, Asenath. Khnum's ram's horns, his most conspicuous feature, play a prominent part in the Abraham legends. Well, let's knock another one off, should we, here, just see what we've got. There's Petra. Well, now, this is a rare thing. Nothing like this was ever found before until it was found in King Tut's tomb. This is in King Tut's tomb. It's a carefully made wooden carved reproduction of Tut himself lying on a lion couch. You can't see it here because it's inside. He's lying on the lion couch, and there are two birds. There are two birds coming, not one, but two over him. You can't have them hovering over him in a wooden... you have to have them just on top of him. Each has one wing over him, so that they're sheltering with one wing. But you know, one is Horus, and has a hawk's head, and the other has a human head. It's his own Ba, and so they're the same thing. They're the same heart. But this identification this way, this is a very interesting thing. In the round, they've given us that picture of the Joseph Smith. It makes no difference which one you have, whether it's the bird with a human head or it's the bird with a hawk's head, but they're coming. And they say, it's a great mystery and it's a remarkable thing, a wooden carving. After they went to all that trouble, and it was a very special thing just buried with him, and there's nothing else ever found like it. But give us a shot of the next one, though, would you? We have it here. Anyway, here's Neith in a quite late coffin here. You see where she is. There's the Hepru down here, the Becomings. You notice there, well, on the sides, it doesn't show well in that picture, but there are stars above each of these. These are stars, and there are 12 here. They're 12 on either side to go through the room. And she, of course, here are the signs of the zodiac. That shows it's late. And here's the Hepru. This is the Becoming. And here is the ape that we have in our figures 16 and 17 in the Joseph Smith, the worshiping ape here. And the other things. Yeah, this is the lady Khnum, who was, who was held in high esteem, Khnum's wife. But shoot another one, will you? These are such, you never know what you get. Yeah, there's Khnum creating man on the pot, a potter, you see. He has the ram's head, and he creates man. But he's the god of builders and carpenters and artisans, anyone like that. As the opening line of his hymn said there, he's a character who lovingly builds life and who detests anything that tears down. Having learned these things from Moses Dindrashvili. The excerpts, the experts who saw the Abraham's cosmic group, what do we have here? Yeah. It also, on the hypocephalus, symbolic of every phase of creative and recreative power. The experts who saw Abraham's cosmic views reflected both in the Book of the Dead and the Shield of Achilles could not be expected to make the connection with the hypocephalus because the hypocephalus isn't published. That's not published in any of the ordinary Books of the Dead because they considered it too late and too alien. But now we know it was very old and it was alien, all right, strange sort of thing. So the people at that conference, nobody was aware of the fact that if they'd had the 162nd section of the Book of the Dead, they would have known that this has a lot to do with hypocephalus. But first, the description of the shield itself. It was circular, antix, Homer says, with a broad outer rim representing the cosmic stream of Oceanus. You can just use regular hypocephalus to represent this, as far as it goes. Your Egyptian waters of Nun. The big circle was covered with cryptic writing, the whole thing as ours is, of course. Recondite symbols displaying the sun, the moon, and the constellations. The constellations given are the primary Egyptian constellations, the five, the Pleiades, Hyades, Orion, Ursa Major, and Ophiuchus. And instead of giving the signs of the zodiac, of course this is much older, this gives the five Egyptian constellations, the primary. The circle was divided into two parts, we're told, like any hypocephalus, the one depicting the world at peace, the other the world at war. Central to the peaceful scene was a law court in full session, which we find on our hypocephalus, along with the happier aspects of the civilized town and country life. On the dark side are all the horrors of war and the destruction were depicted in detail. Again, we are faced with the essentially aloof, archaic nature of our hypocephalus story, for the account of the shield has long been recognized as an independent and very ancient composition, almost an intrusion, has nothing to do with the rest of the Iliad. However, skillfully adapted by Homer, furthermore, it is the shield, not the armor, which is the subject of the book of the shield. It's called his panoply, but the shield gets 130 lines and the armor only gets 4. The hypocephalus design was apparently no invention of late antiquity, and neither is the story behind it. This takes us back at least as far as Homer, you see. This is how they got the shield. Now, this is the interesting story, how they got the shield. Well. The scene opens with great mourning. Are you surprised? Ostensibly for Patroclus, but in reality for Achilles himself, who lies flat on the ground throwing ashes on himself, behaving just like a Cenus, you see. Throwing ashes over himself while maidens sing of his coming demise, and the seven maidens of Cenith did the same thing, you see. But now it's Achilles of all people. After restraining him from cutting his own throat in a sacrificial fashion, his mother Thetis bids him a fond farewell, clasping his head and wailing. Achilles is ready. Let me die at once, he says. I shall never return home again. But whoever is being lamented, the whole funeral operation, including the sacrifice of Hector with the 12 Trojan victims sacrificed at the mound of Patroclus, must be suspended until somebody goes to heaven and gets something. Gets the nemesis, gets the shield. Goes to heaven to the mount, must be suspended until Thetis, the heavenly go-between, who, for this special occasion and nowhere else, takes the form of a hawk, you might suppose, goes to heaven to get the shield. They can't go to the funeral, nothing can go on until they get the shield, and so she gets the shield, which has, of course, the pictures of the heaven and all that sort of thing, and she brings it back again. While she's gone, another rescuer, let's go back to the beginning, you know, Book of the Dead 78, Coffin Text 312, tell this story. While she's gone, another rescuer, this is the false angel, you see. She's called an angel, Angelos, Homer calls her, a messenger, swift iris, with all the colors of the rainbow, like a true Ahu or Minute bird. And by a quaint coincidence, also the iris of the eye, since the hypocephalus represents the eye, iris of an eye, puts in an appearance and takes over. Also, she is a false messenger, since she has come without knowledge or permission of Zeus or the other gods, as we turn lines 185 following. She tells Achilles to make an effort to bestir herself, the way the two ladies always do, to the supine Horus. He complies, and as he rises, quote, from the head of Achilles, flame mounted to heaven. And the opposing hosts, when they saw the unextinguishable fire blazing around the head of Achilles, were paralyzed with fear. Even so, when Abraham rose from the sacrificial blaze at Ur, and Book of Abraham is supposed to be Abraham being sacrificed, see, that's a sacrifice. The terrified soldiers and bystanders, he terrified the soldiers and bystanders by the flames surrounding him. Oh, they were consumed, actually, by the flames surrounding him. So the same thing. As if to spare us nothing, next comes the grim sunset, as, quote, all night long the Achaeans made moan and lamentation, a night of unrelieved gloom and horror, horror of great darkness, Genesis 15. While all are mourning for Achilles, his mother, in the imperishable starry abode above, notice that, the imperishable stars, the ichimsek of the Egyptians, that's the common Egyptian expression, the imperishable stars, the northern stars, that's where you go to heaven. You come from heaven from the direction of, if you're traveling in space, you must come from the direction of Orion, and if you're leaving the earth, you must go in the direction of the Great Bear. They always do that, I very insist on that. Well, anyway, she goes to the imperishable starry abode, the Ichimsek, and mounts to the throne of the Most High. She consults with the Creator and gets the shield, returning to earth like a hawk sweeping down from cloudy Olympus. It's the only time she goes out of the way to take that form. Her arrival makes it possible for Achilles to complete his earthly mission, and then the proper funeral. So we have not only the object itself, but the way in which it was acquired has the same story. And we go way back to Homer here. The most interesting question in all the material criticism of Homer, that's a quotation from Milner, is how the poetic image got transferred to a material shield. Levi had such a shield. He got a spiritual shield from the angel, but then he had a real shield when he landed. The hypocephalus connection clears up the matter, I think. The solid shield brought from above is solid proof that the bearer has been there. It's around, this round star planet chart is that every visitor brings back with him, instructs his children, teaches you that there's more beyond, and that we're concerned with it, we belong in the cosmos. What you say is when you bring that back. The answer to the terrible question is, yes, I have been there. And this is the insurance that reconciles the moribund hero to his fate. Now, Pythagoras, you know all about him, to prove that he had been to the other world, he brought back with him what? The shield of Achilles. And he deposited it in the temple of Delphi, the most holy place where the initiates, he said, could have the privilege of seeing it. It was a sacred and a secret object. Some say it was the shield of Menelaus instead, and Diogenes and like. But here it is, you see. You bring this object, after Abraham has been given the vision and so forth, he gives us this picture, leaves it to his children, but you always must, we mentioned before, only a few select persons are able to take this trip, you see. So they're always told, they're instructed, they must make a copy of this for their posterity, and that's what Abraham did, of course. And the same thing here. And also, moreover, something else here. Diogenes Laertes. says that Pythagoras was thought to be the son of Hermes, who told him, now here again we get the usual theme, who told him to make any wish he wanted, it would be granted, with one exception: he couldn't live forever. He could go to heaven, but he'd have to come back and die, exactly like the others, see. Accordingly, he asked that he might have both in the flesh and here, that's exactly what Abraham says, that I may, while still in the flesh, I may see the heavenly abodes and so forth, so that he can come and report. In the flesh and after death, a knowledge of everything, namely came to simviantum, to be aware of all and or to be the benefactor of all mankind with his knowledge. And after he dies, he says, to retain the same memory after death. When he received this gift from Hermes, he was also granted power to wander freely as a spirit and enter any body he pleased. That's the well-known Egyptian form. Remember, I can take any form I want for the dead. He is always reincarnated as the greatest man of his time. And it said, this Diogenes there, he says that he set up the shield of Menelaus in the temple of Delphi. So there we have the idea that he set up a witness that he had been there, even Pythagoras. And it's the shield again. So we get the Minoan mysteries. And we find here the shield of Perseus was another such memento. It was polished to serve as a cosmic mirror. And by it, Athena gave the flying hero, Perseus, instruction in the nature of the universe. Well, there we have it again, another shield, another flying hero coming back and so forth, benefactor of the human race. So, plainly, we're dealing with a strange dimension here. Well, I have time for the story of Air now. Plato, who took solid comfort, as he tells us, from the evidence of another such visit to heaven, and it's real to him. It's not, again, it's a usual out-of-the-way source. It was Air, the Armenian. I'll write the whole name out for you. Air, E-R, Air the Armenian. We all know Air the Armenian, from the end of the Republic, you know. Plato assures us that he takes Air's story quite literally, that it gives him faith and comfort. Left for dead on the battlefield, for 10 days, there's a prime candidate, you see, for the hero who dies but doesn't die, Air revived only to find himself on his own funeral pyre with the flames burning brightly around him. Arising phoenix-like from the fire, he tells us his story of the 10 days. He gets out, they get him out before he's burned, but where did he go meantime? First, his spirit left his body along with those of the others slain in battle. They arrived at some supernatural daimonium place, where they beheld the usual polarized universe, two chasms between which two judges sit holding court. Here we go again. Plato's telling an Armenian story just as he'd been studying the Jewish Apocrypha, see? The usual polarized verse, two chasms between the two judges sit holding court, with the righteous moving to the right and those guilty to the left. Air is guided by an angelic messenger who tells him, quote, to listen and observe everything in this place and to make a record of it. There's part of the story too, you see. Since he must return to Earth later. He does. After 7 days in a sort of marshalling area, he's shown the structure of the universe in what Giorgio Santayana calls the complete planetarium, as it's described. Plato himself calls it a schema, that is, an actual model or drawing, in which, quote, within the revolving circle of seven circles are three thrones, the seven heavens, the three thrones. The place contains all sorts of exotic animals whose forms are symbolic of their spiritual conditions. They'd be hieroglyphs, as far as that goes, like the ideograms and the hieroglyphs, but not necessarily. There are four colors and four directions, and in their midst the zenith of heaven, minding all things and coordinating all things. All must drink from the great river before passing through the fire again to another genesis. They have to pass through the ring, which was the great water of noon. So there's the story in Plato. And he quotes it as an ancient story and one which he really believes in. For Plato, he says at the end, the story of Air is more than a symbolic. It is gospel. It will actually save us, he says, if we too follow it. Plato's teacher Socrates also declared immediately before his death that he fully expected to stand trial before the throne in a real court in another world. In the Crito, tells us that. But now we must turn to the classical sources, which depict the hypocephalous images of far earlier time than Plato and Er. Well, I don't want to get started on this next theme now. Let's see the rest of the pictures. We can at least talk about them. Oh, that's this one, yes. That's the hymn that he talks about. And you'll notice various things here. Here he talks about the seven knums. the passing through the waters of the seven knums here, and he creates the four knums, the material of all the universe from four of them, and these are the two parts, and this is the rest. This is Esne, where he is, you see, the Esne, the breath of life, and yes, and the Herpet, Herpet. Yes, he comes forth under the heaven and form in the form of Re. See, its Knum is, he emerges in the form of Re here. And there's your phoenix bird, you see. E Panti, you Pahin. O thou who art the phoenix, you see. Ker Gerig, in building or constructing thy great works, is Katia M. Katiev, who is ingenious, that's contriving ingeniously in his buildings. And so it goes. And we get down to the other. Well, let's have another one here. Don't want to get stuck. Well, this is the Joseph Smith. You recognize this, but we'll get on to it. It was to show you something, but let's see the next one now. Yeah, there it is. That's Shu, you see. This is King Tut's headdress, his own personal headdress. You notice the two lions facing in both directions. That's Ruti, the double lions that mark the way in and the way out of the other world. They guard it. And this is to hold your head up. I don't know how comfortable it would be to sleep with your head in that. Couldn't move it or anything else. But the inscription on it says that this is Shu, and by holding you up here, he is not only raising your head, but he is raising you to the heights of the heaven, to the other world. So it serves the same function as a hypocephalus. It is under the head, and Shu is the one who's holding it up. That's the space between heaven and earth. He is the one who sustains, who separated heaven and earth in the beginning. Well, let's see the next one then. That's an important thing to have. This was to show you the three main divisions, that's all. That you always find three main divisions. Of course, in the beginning, in the middle, you see the four heads on one. And it has they have the goat's horns and the sun above it. Well, let's go on now. And the worshiping apes. That's to show you the same thing. That's Knum here. And the next one, this was to have some. Now there's a. Ah, see. Oh, we get to Janus now. Well, we better talk about this sort of thing the next time. Well, this is Khonsu. This is something else. Well, we didn't get as far as I hoped to because. But look, what are we talking about here now? You recognize that the themes are many and they fit together. They go back very anciently and they cover an awful lot of ground. We mentioned, remember, the Babylonian sort of things in here. But they're not in the mainstream. We're in one great tradition here, apparently. One great cycle, one thing. And the oldest, the center of it, it all comes back to Abraham when you come to these. He's the one that starts it out. Somebody must have practiced this earlier. But what is this practice going on? Have other people had the same experiences? Well, of course, this is part, in the Old Testament, you get that. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all go through the same type of experience, and so does Judah, and so does Joseph. If you search their travels and their afflictions, their troubles with the wives and so forth, and marriage. We're dealing with patterns here, and this is a big, bold pattern, and this is the one that was first splashed before us by Joseph Smith when he gave us the explanation. We haven't talked about the explanation of the hypocephalus. We'll see how that rings the bell later on, how he calls all these shots and touches all the bases there. But first we have to have a foundation here. You know, there's something beside this, but what my old Professor Wilson said, it's just a mixed jumble of confusion, unrelated charms and symbols. Talismans. Of course, they're not confused and underrated at all. When you get 50 of them that show exactly the same arrangement, exactly the same order, you're not dealing with something jumbled and random at all. So this is a work which we're not exactly helpless. Our only purpose now is to find out just what is behind this. And when we start getting behind anything like this, one thing leads to another, as you can see. The Egyptians are right in the center, everything is whirling around it, and the Jews are handing it on to us, and so your head swims before you're over with. But these things, some of them can be set in a time, and some things set in a place, and it all comes back when the Joseph Smith is going to have anything to apologize for, believe me. He was right in on the ground floor, as we hope to show at a later time. Well, thank you. Sorry to keep you late.